gosh.
Drop it.
Can we like get it over and stuff?
What is it?
Mercury.
Is it Mercury?
We should be playing catch with it, right?
No, don't tip it.
Sorry.
So happy.
It is so.
Yeah, it does. Don't tip it.
Did you lift it, Sebastian? Good. Okay, let's get going. So we're talking about how people really learned about structure of organic molecules. And in particular about the chemical revolution. But although people usually date the start of chemistry to the chemical revolution, there was a background to it in practical medicinal medicinal chemistry, metallurgy, alchemy even. And in fact, if you looked at the Science Times yesterday, you can see that they're right up to date because they were talking about what we were talking about last lecture. Here you see they have the headlines in the Science Times about Newton's intellectual passion, alchemy, which he kept hidden from view. And if you click at the bottom here when you have this on your machine, you'll get taken to this web page, which is about the chemistry of Isaac Newton, where you can click and see various notebooks and so on that he did, that he worked on but never published. Okay, this lab looks like an alchemical lab. Apparatus you see there is the same thing the alchemists used, but in fact it was someone who was crucial in initiating the chemical revolution, this pharmacist from Sweden named Carl Wilhelm Scheele, who died in 1786. We can usually date 1789 as the beginning of modern chemistry for reasons you'll soon see. Okay, that's a stamp that Sweden issued to honor Scheele, but the picture isn't Scheele. The costume he's wearing came in long after Scheele died. There is no picture of Scheele. Now, Scheele did a lot of important things. One of them was to isolate pure samples of organic solids that you could use, and some liquids as well. And the carboxylic acids are a good example of that. For example, I show the structure on the right, which of course he had no means of knowing, but lactic acid he isolated. Where do you think he got it from? Lactic acid. Where from? Milk, sour milk, right? Okay, so lactic acid came from milk. Here's the paper in which he reported it on milk and its acid, which was published by the Royal Swedish Science Academy. 1780. Now, how did he purify these things? He cured them as salts. Salts with heavy metals would sometimes be crystalline. Here he said, for example, in that paper, bismuth, cobalt, antimony, tin, mercury, silver, gold were attacked by lactic acid, either by digestion, that's just sitting there, or by boiling. After standing over tin, the acid caused a black precipitate to form in the solution of gold in aqua regia. And number 8, iron and zinc were dissolved with formation of flammable air. What's that? When you put an acid with a metal, what flammable air do you get? It was on the written on the wall of the people that were 100 years ago down the street here. Zinc and sulfuric acid gave hydrogen gas. Okay, that's the flammable air. The iron solution was brown and gave no crystallization, but the zinc solution crystallized. So the zinc solution crystallized. That meant he could purify things, right, and get pure samples of from things that were mixtures of organic stuff. That was what was crucial. Okay, number 9, he said, with copper, our solution first took on a blue color, then green, finally dark blue, but it did not crystallize, so he wasn't able to purify that one. Lead dissolved after several days of digestion. The solution acquired a sweet, tart taste, but did not crystallize, so he was tasting the lead salts. So the people didn't know what risks they were taking in those days with these heavy metals. But at any rate, because of heroes like this, we got samples of a lot of acids, like citric acid. Where'd that come from? From lemons, right? Or uric acid, from urine, obviously. Or tartaric acid. Tartaric acid came from tartar, which is the deposit that would form inside wine casks. Benzoic acid. That came from gum benzoin. There's a really interesting story about where the name of gum benzoin comes from, but we don't have time to tell it now. Finally, oxalic acid. Where did oxalic acid come from? From rhubarb. Now, how do you get the name oxalic if it comes from rhubarb? Right? Oxy is a Greek prefix meaning sharp. Okay, you may know that from the word oxymoron, right? Which doesn't mean a stupid ox. What it means is something that's a sharp dullness. It's a word that's self-contradictory, right? You can't have a sharp dullness, right? That's what an oxymoron is. So oxy means sharp. Now, what's sharp about rhubarb? Why would you say it's sharp? Why do you get oxalic acid from rhubarb? The taste is sharp, right? It has an acidic taste. That comes from the Latin acidus, which comes from the Greek oxus, the sharp. That the acid means sharp. So, and that comes from acra to mean sour, which comes from the root ac, which means sharp. Okay, so that's where oxalic acid came from. Now, what do these compounds have in common that we notice nowadays that makes them sharp? Makes them acid. Right, they have the carboxylic acid group. And we already looked at that last time, that it's not a carbonyl alcohol, it's a carboxylic acid, where you have this resonance, which means that the high HOMO is stabilized in the starting material, but it's even more stabilized in the product because it's a higher HOMO with a negative charge. So this favors going to the ionized form, the anion form. So whereas the alcohol would have a pKa of about 16, a carboxylic acid has 10 to the 11th stronger as an acid. So the pKa depends on the difference between AH and A minus H plus. So even though AH is stabilized, the carboxylic group is stabilized by resonance, the anion is stabilized even more, right? So it favors dissociation. Okay, now you may have noticed that there was one of these that doesn't have a carboxylic acid group, uric acid. So why is it acidic? Here's another chance to exercise your skill at identifying functional groups. What makes it acidic? It doesn't have a COOH. Yeah. It's got ketones. Are ketones acidic? What makes something acidic? A low LUMO. So does a carbonyl have a low LUMO? C double bond O, unusually low LUMO. What is it? Name it. Pi star, right? Poor overlap plus the oxygen is low. So indeed it is. But ketones don't taste acidic, right? There must be something more here that enables it to function as an acid. So if we look at this, we see that this unshared pair, which would make it basic normally, is unusually stabilized, both by this HOMO interacting with this LUMO, right, and by the HOMO interacting with this LUMO, right? So this starting material is very stable, right? It's not basic the way you would expect at this nitrogen, the way you would expect a normal amine to be. It's more like an amide. Those electron pairs are low in energy because these acidic, the low LUMOs here, stabilize it, as shown here. But if you lose a proton from that nitrogen, then you have a higher HOMO and even more stabilization. So it's the same trick as you have in the carboxylic acid. The thing that's lost a proton is very much stabilized. So that gives this a pKa of 5.8, almost as high, almost as acidic as a carboxylic acid, whereas a normal amine, to lose a proton from a normal amine and get NH2- has a pKa of 38. So this is 20, more than 22 powers of 10 better at dissociating because of this functional group. So that's just a little more rehearsal on functional groups. Of course, Scheele knew nothing about that. But Scheele was able to discover a lot of elements. 7 elements he discovered. They're arranged more or less the way they are in the periodic table. They are in a periodic table. But a particularly interesting one is tungsten, because that's a Swedish name. It comes from tungsten, which means heavy stone in Swedish. Remember that Scheele was Swedish. Okay, now, these three are special because they're gases. There are not many elements that are gases, but those are. So he isolated those. Here, for example, is what he did in 1771. He took silver carbonate and heated it very strongly. That's about all you could do in those days to take things apart, is try to heat them and see what happens. And when you heated it, CO2 came off and you got silver oxide. And then he really heated it to more than 340 degrees Celsius, and it became silver plus O2, which came off, so he could generate the O2. And he called it Feuerluft, which in German, which he spoke, is fire air, because, as you know, it supports combustion. And he wrote the letter. This is the last page of it, which is in the Swedish Academy of Sciences. And he wrote it from Uppsala in September 1774. He had done this experiment in 1771. And what he was asking was for someone to try this experiment. So he outlined what all the experiment was. You can see the letter and its translation on the web. But he says, since I have no large burning glass, I beg you to try with yours. So he wanted to focus the rays of the sun with a big magnifying glass on the sample and see if you could do this same thing and generate oxygen. He never got a reply to this letter. Right, but the letter was to Lavoisier in Paris, who had a burning glass like this. See his sunglasses he's wearing? Okay, so he had the ability to do it, and he did do experiments like that, but he never wrote back to Scheele. Right? So Lavoisier is one of the discoverers of oxygen, and Priestley in England, but Scheele actually did it first in 1771. Okay? Now we're into the chemical revolution, which was founded by Lavoisier, whatever you think of his morals in this particular episode. Okay, and notice that he didn't teach. He didn't have any students. I mean, people came and worked with him sometimes, but the things he worked on were analysis and inorganic nomenclature. What a funny thing to work on in order to create a chemical revolution. So let's look a little bit at Lavoisier. So this is 1789. We're talking about the chemical revolution, which dates from 1789. But this is 1789 too. Do you know what that is? Right? This is the beginning of the French Revolution in the tennis court at Versailles. Right? In fact, Everyone here except about two are lawyers, right? And there's one guy here who looks very down at the mouth. He's over here someplace. Because he got this guy, right? Because he was not appreciated by the rest of the people. But this was the source, the root of modern chemistry as well as of modern France, okay? Now, the Indo-European reconstructed source of the word root is verot, which means root, right? And it comes into all sorts of languages. For example, Wurzel in German means root. Wort, like St. John's wort, is a root. Licorice, the rich part of it is ritsa from Greek, which means root. Race, you know, of peoples, the root of a people is razza in Italian. Rutabaga is Swedish, which has the same word in it. Rhotix in Latin is the one that's most relevant to us. Can you think of words that come from rhotix, meaning root? Radical, we're going to get to. But a very routine one is radish. Okay? Eradicate. What does eradicate mean? To pull out by the roots. Absolutely, right? But of course, radical, which means going to the root or origin. So you think it was first used in mathematics in the 16th century. You look at the root of some number is what multiplied by itself gives that number, right? The source of the number, the square root. Or radical was used in politics in 18th century England and in chemistry in 18th century France. In fact, this is in the Oxford English Dictionary, the first use they cite of radical as a political term is from the year 1787 by a guy named Jebb, who said the necessity of a substantial and radical reform in representation. And here is 1787, a radical document of the same period, right? And radical was introduced as a chemical term in 1787, all this in 1787, by Louis Bernard Guiton de Morveau, who was at that time 50 years old. Here's a picture of him. Now, this was in connection with the méthode de nomenclature chimique, the method of chemical nomenclature, right? Not experiments per se, but how to talk about molecules. So 1787, this was with Berthollet, who was younger, 35, and Fourcroy, who was only 32. And the most important person in this was Lavoisier, right? So this picture was painted. So here he is at 45 years old, and he lived to only be 49 years old, right? Has anybody seen this painting? Usually there's someone in the class who has. It's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, right? It was painted for them by the artist David, and they paid him £7,000 for the painting, which is the equivalent of $300,000. They had a lot of money. They were very wealthy. There's a very interesting story about Lavoisier and his wife, who was much younger than he. But this picture, when people had their pictures or pictures painted, statues done, and so on, they chose to put in them things that were very significant to them, right? So the things you see in this are very significant to Lavoisier, because at that time he's working on writing this book, Traité élémentaire de chimie. Here's a facsimile of the book here, okay, and it's in two volumes, okay, but. The book, at the back of the book in the second volume, there are a bunch of drawings. I could fold one of them out here like this, which show chemical apparatus, right? And these drawings show things like this, okay? But you see that these things that are in the book are what's in the picture, right? Like that bell jar there is this one. Or that thing is here, the eudiometer. Or this big bulb with a valve on it is down here, right? Or this valve is at the end of it, okay? And it was done by Paul's Lavoisier Sculpsit. That's the person who did the picture. And that's her. His wife did that. She worked with him in lab. And this portfolio over here is her drawings that she made for this book. Okay. She also painted this. That's a family friend, Benjamin Franklin. We showed you that picture earlier. Okay, so this is that picture that's in the book. And it's an apparatus for weighing a gas. If you think about that, that sounds like a tough challenge. How do you weigh a gas? Okay, so let's see how you did it. Okay, first you had to generate a gas. So you heat something here that generates a gas, and it bubbles into this bell jar full of mercury, maybe. And then the mercury gets displaced, and now you have a bell jar full of the gas. Okay, so you can do the same thing with this jar here. First you evacuate this thing, right? So you open this, put it on a pump. Everything is pumped out of here. So there's nothing in there. And you weigh it. Okay? Then you treat this the way you did that, and bubbles will come up and will fill that jar, and the mercury will go down. Right? So now you have a jar full of it sitting in a dish of mercury, this on this table that has mercury in it. Okay? And then you open the valves, and of course it sucks the mercury back up and the gas goes into the vacuum. Okay? And you know how do you know what the pressure of the gas is? Because obviously the weight of a gas will depend, a certain volume will depend on the pressure. That's Boyle's law from way back when. How do you know what the pressure is? That's the difference between atmospheric pressure, right, and the pressure in the bulb. Okay, so now you turn the valves back off and unscrew that thing and go weigh it. And now you know the weight of a certain volume. You've weighed it with water in it first to know what the volume of A is. So you know the volume, you know the pressure, and now you know the weight. So you know how much the gas weighs. Okay, so that's clever. And here's Lavoisier working on this, holding a bell jar in a trough of mercury here. There's a jar with mercury in it. Now, some of you have lifted mercury. What do you think about Lavoisier? He must have been a pretty stout person, right, to be able to do that. Okay, and here's Madame over here taking notes and drawing pictures of the experiments that are taken. She drew this picture. Okay, now, right now in Paris, there's at the Musée des Arts et Métiers, there's instruments from the laboratory of Lavoisier. So here we can see things, like here is this trough that would have mercury in it and the jar with the valve on top of it. What's this thing here? That's his burning glass that Shayla wanted him to use, or part of one of his burning glasses. This thing over here we'll talk about, that's called a calorimeter. And these two big things we'll talk about later too. You can see they're quite substantial. What they are is a barrel here hooked onto something up above it and another barrel inside it. So we'll talk about those later. Okay, so this is the book, the Traité élémentaire de chimie, the Elementary Treatise of Chemistry, published in 1789. Okay. And the important thing is that it's presented in a new order and according to modern discoveries. He says that we're not putting a lot of history in here. It's not a lot. This is the new stuff. Okay. And it has figures, the one that Madame Lavoisier drew. Okay. And it's 1789. Notice that he's a member of all sorts of academies, including Philadelphia. Why would he be a member of the Science Academy of Philadelphia? Because he's a pal of Benjamin Franklin, right? Okay, now, one of the really important documents in history and literature is the preliminary discourse, the introduction to this book. It's absolutely wonderful, and I really recommend that you read it. I think I've got it on the website. But this is what it says. I had no other object when I began the following work than to extend and explain more fully the memoir I had read at the public meeting of the Academy of Science in 1787. Remember, that's when the word radical started up? On the necessity of reforming and completing the nomenclature of chemistry. So what a weird thing, right? That it's working to do the nomenclature that caused the chemical revolution. While engaged in this employment, I perceived better than I'd ever done before the justice of the following maxims of the Abbé de Condillac in his Systems of Logic and some of his other works. So he was reforming and completing the nomenclature of chemistry. And this is what the Abbé said. We think only through the medium of words. Languages are true analytical methods. Algebra, which is adapted to its purpose in every species of expression, is the most simple, most exact, and best manner possible, is at the same time a language and an analytical method. The art of reasoning is nothing more than language well arranged. Lavoisier then continues, thus, while I thought myself employed only in forming a nomenclature, and while I proposed to myself nothing more than to improve chemical language, my work transformed itself by degrees, without my being able to prevent it, into a treatise upon the elements of chemistry. So by trying to make things clear and the language correct, he completely revised what chemistry was. The impossibility of separating the nomenclature of a science from the science itself is owing to this, that every branch of science must consist of three things: the series of facts, which are the object of the science, the ideas that represent the facts, and the words by which these ideas are expressed. Like three impressions of the same seal, the words ought to produce the idea, and the idea to be a picture of the fact. Right? So facts, the things you do experimentally, ideas that you form about them, and the words. You can't have and manipulate the ideas without the words, is what Condillac said. Okay, three impressions of the same seal. And as ideas are preserved and communicated by means of words, it necessarily follows that we cannot improve the language of any science without at the same time improving the science itself. Neither can we, on the other hand, improve a science without improving the language or nomenclature that belongs to it. However certain the facts of any science may be, and however just the ideas we may have formed of these facts, we can only communicate false impressions to others while we want words by which they may be properly expressed. So they're inseparable, the idea of improving the language and improving the ideas of a science. So his focus is on clarity. Notice the contrast with the alchemists whose idea was to hide things from other people and use complicated words and codes and so on so that people wouldn't understand that they didn't really know anything, primarily, right? But Lavoisier's idea was to make everything clear for people. That's why at the end of the book they have all these pictures of how the apparatus works. So if you have enough money, you could build them and repeat exactly the same experiments or continue the experiments. So the facts, that's the experiments, right? The ideas and the words. And these are all impressions of the same seal, right? They absolutely communicate with one another. So the other thing about this book is that he's presenting things in a new order. Nothing historical about it, right? One thing he's presenting is the doctrine, that's the ideas. Another is the nomenclature, the words. And third, the operations, how you actually do things and collect the facts. And that's why the second volume has all this information about how exactly you do experiments. Okay? And he discussed the idea of elements. He said, if by the name of elements we mean to designate the simple, indivisible molecules, and notice he doesn't mean molecule in exactly the same sense that we do. The ule end means something that's really tiny. Okay? So just the tiniest little things. If we say that there are elements which are indivisible molecules that make up substances, it's probable we do not know what they are. Right? But if, on the contrary, we associate with the name of elements or the principles of substances the idea of the furthest stage to which analysis can reach, so it's an experimental definition of what an element is. You do different things, like heat things, like as Shayla did, until you can't break them down anymore. And then the things you have at that stage you will call elements. The furthest stage to which analysis can reach, then all substances that we have so far found no means to decompose are elements for us. Somebody later might... So, we have a table of the elements here. Are they elements by this definition? Can they be broken down? Yeah, you can get electrons out, protons, neutrons, and so on. So really, there are things more elementary than the elements, right? But this got solidified, the chemical elements as a table. But for Lavoisier, it was as far as you could go with analysis. They behave with respect to us like simple, that is, indivisible substances. So he has the table, then, of the simple substances. This is an English translation, obviously, of the book that was published 2 years later in Scotland. Okay, so this is a table of the simple substances, the elements. And look at what the first two are. They're called imponderable elements. What does imponderable mean? You can't weigh them, right? You can weigh even gases, but you can't weigh these things, right? Light and caloric, right? So if you have caloric, if it's an element, you have to have some way of measuring it. You can't weigh it. So you need a meter to measure caloric, a calorimeter. So in 1782, Lavoisier, together with Laplace, who was a scientist but became better known as a mathematician, built this calorimeter. And this was the device, which shown here in whole, that you saw down in the right-hand corner of the stuff at the museum. Okay, so now what is it? Notice first that it's pretty big. That's a scale of 3 feet. Okay? So what you have is a lamp in which you'll burn an oil. It'll give off caloric, and you want to measure how much caloric there was in the oil that you're getting out by the burning. Okay? So you put the lamp into that bucket, put the lid on the bucket so just the wick and the flame are coming out. And then you put the bucket down inside that wire cage and put the lid on, a wire lid. And then you put that down inside this double-walled can. Okay? So now you got the flame burning in here with this lid on it. But then you put another lid. Here's looking at it from the top, right? You put another lid on top of that. Okay? And now you've got the flame going there, right? So it's giving off heat, and you want to measure how much heat it's coming off. Right? So the idea is, you fill this space here with ice, right? Not only here, but also the lid and the top of this and this outer can as well. Now, why do you need two cans? What's going to cause... So the flame is completely surrounded by melting ice, and you'll see how much ice gets melted, and that's going to measure how much heat you have, right? But what's the problem if that was all there was to it? There'd be heat from the room going in, too. But that's what's clever about this. You surround the inner can completely by ice that serves as an insulator. So any heat that comes in from the outside melts this ice, not this ice. And the same from the top. Right? So it's completely surrounded at 0 degrees by this ice. Right? So the only thing that will cause the light blue ice to melt is the heat from the candle. Isn't that clever? Okay, so it heats and then it melts and you get liquid in there. Some of the ice melts. And then at the end of the experiment, you put this thing underneath and open the tap and see how much water came out. And that's how much caloric was generated. So it was important to be able to measure these elements. So this measured the element caloric. And that's a picture of the device in reality. Okay, so it was this new order, the doctrine, the nomenclature, and the operations. Okay, so the doctrine is ideas, the nomenclature is words, and the operation are the facts. So, the facts come from analysis. So this is the Oxford English Dictionary, which you have access to because you're at Yale, which is fun to find out what these things are. So analysis, you see, comes from the Greek meaning back and to loose. So to loosen things back, to take things apart. So generally, it means the breaking up of anything complex into its various simple elements. That's analyzing a problem, right? And it's the opposite is synthesis, to put things together. Okay? the exact determination of elements or components of anything complex. And in particular, as applied to chemistry, the resolution of a chemical compound into its proximate or ultimate elements. Now, what's proximate and ultimate? Ultimate means as far as you can go, like Lavoisier said, right? So a use in 1791 was the quantity of charcoal which a substance yields by analysis. That's how much carbon, right? That goes back to an element that's on our periodic table, okay? But there's also the idea of proximate analysis, where you find out, this is like what you see on a candy bar or something in the grocery store, right? How much sugar, how much starch, how much gum. Those are proximate principles. They're not elements, right? They themselves can be taken apart, right? But you can do proximate analysis, too. Okay, so in this traité élémentaire de chimie with facts and theories and words, you have this list of the elements, which was the equivalent in those days of the periodic table, except it wasn't periodic. So we've seen that you had light, and you had caloric as elements. And the idea of a gas was interesting to him. He said, the word gas is for us a generic name that designates the ultimate degree of saturation of whatever substance by caloric. So if you have some substance, you can put caloric with it. And if you put enough caloric, it becomes a gas, right? So you heat things and boil them, for example. Okay, so a gas is a substance that's saturated with the element caloric. So a caloric plus some base or radical, the root of something, gives rise to a gas. Okay, so oxygen, what is that? Notice, incidentally, these are the old names that people used to use for those. These are his new systematic names. So oxygen, he says, we have given to the base of the portion of air that supports respiration the name oxygen, deriving it from two Greek words, oxus, which means acid, sharp, we talked about that, and genomai, which is to cause to be. So it's what makes things into acids, oxygen, acid making. Okay? Because in fact, one of the most general properties of this base, this element, is forming acids by combining with most substances. We shall thus call oxygen gas the combination of this base with caloric. Now, of course, he never saw oxygen that wasn't a gas, so oxygen was always, by his view, saturated with caloric. Okay, so oxygen is a base or radical, and combined with a radical gives an acid from that radical. So, for example, combining oxygen with sulfur gave sulfuric acid with phosphorus, phosphoric acid with charcoal, carbonic acid, right? Okay, now, so these things were all elements, or base, or radical, the fundamental thing, but combined with oxygen, they gave an acid. Okay, now azote. Has anybody ever heard the name azote? What is it?
It means nitrogen.
It means nitrogen in French. So that's the word that Lavoisier used for nitrogen, right? Now, what does he say about it? Since the chemical properties of the part of the atmospheric air that does not support respiration were not well known, we were content to deduce the name of its base from the properties of its gas to take the life of animals that breathed it. So if you put a mouse into an atmosphere of nitrogen, it took away its life. So we have named it azote, from the Greek privative, take away, and from zoe, life. So it takes away life, azote, right? Thus, the unbreathable part of air would be azotic gas. So there would be this element, azote, you combine it with caloric, and it becomes a gas, nitrogen gas, azotic gas. Okay. Besides, it has been shown to enter also into nitric acid compounds. So one could just as properly named it the nitrogen principle. And that's, of course, what took on in English. Ultimately, we had to reject the name, which conveyed a systematic idea, and decided to avoid this risk of fooling ourselves by adopting the names azote and azotic gas, which expresses only a fact, or better, a property, that of taking the life of animals that breathe this gas. And hydrogen, what does that mean? What is the name? Notice he's making words that mean something about facts. He's improving the nomenclature. Hydrogen? Not it comes from water. What does gen mean? It makes water. So when it combines with oxygen, right, you get water. Okay? We find ourselves forced to give a name. Nothing seems more convenient to us than hydrogen. That is to say, the generating principle of water. From hedor, water, and from genomai, again, cause to be. We shall call this combinate of this principle with caloric, hydrogen gas. The word hydrogen alone will stand for the base of the same gas, the radical of water. So oxygen plus the radical hydrogen gives water. Okay? So this idea of radical was really important. That's what the elements were. So there were other radicals which are still unknown, right? Like the muriatic radical, the fluoric radical, the boracic radical. Now, muriatic, you know what acid that gives? Hydrochloric acid is sometimes called muriatic acid still because it comes from the sea, from the mare, right? Muriatic. Okay, now, so what is the element that combined with oxygen gives muriatic acid? That's the idea, right? You take oxygen plus the base, the radical, the muriatic radical, and it becomes an acid. So what is the radical that becomes hydrochloric acid? The scheme isn't perfect, right? There isn't one. Hydrochloric acid doesn't have oxygen in it. It's HCl, no oxygen, right? So he thought there would be one, but it wasn't known yet. Okay, because he's trying to generalize. And then there were things called compound radicals that gave other acids, but they were not single elements. They were known not to be elements. You could take them apart. Like, for example, tartaric acid, citric acid, oxalic acid, benzoic acid, lactic acid. Where have you seen these before? Those are the ones that Shayla isolated, right? And they have the new names for him, these acids. Right? They used to have old names, right? Like lactic acid used to be called the acid of sour whey. Okay? So those are Shayla's acid. Also, lithic acid was one from urinary calculi that Shayla had prepared. That's a real carboxylic acid. So then, to try to put this into the doctrine, to the theory, he has these different oxidation states. So you can add more and more oxygen to some things and get different kinds of acids. So you start with a certain radical, the simple substances, and then you have the first, the second, the third, and the fourth degrees of oxidation. So first you get an oxide, second you get an acid which you call an us acid, third you get an ic acid, and finally you get an oxygenated ic acid. So this is the systematic nomenclature that he's developed to describe this. You have an element, the oxide, the us acid, the ic acid, and the oxygenated ic acid. Now, many of these were unknown, and some of them are still unknown because the system isn't right, or it's perfect yet. Okay. Now, how do you do an analysis? Say you have an oil, and you want to you burn it to do its elemental analysis. Fire takes things apart, right? Now, what we already saw something you could measure by burning oil. What was that? One of its elements. Caloric. You could measure how much caloric was in it with a calorimeter, the ice calorimeter. But this is to measure other elements that are in an oil. Okay, so the idea is that you have an air supply. This is that big barrel we saw, right? And it's got an upside down barrel inside that can be lifted up and down, right? And there's water in here. So there's air trapped in here. And as you let this down, it creates pressure on the air, which is taken off by a pipe inside, comes in here, and through here, right? And then to a place that dries it, okay? Now, there's only a certain amount of air that can be held in the barrel, right? What happens when you run out of air if the oil isn't gone yet? Remember what you saw in the museum? Two barrels. So one is here, there's another one out on this line. So when this one gets near the end, then you start it from, you turn the valve and start it from here, put more air in that one. So you got a continuous supply of air to do the burning. Okay, so air comes in, gets dried here, comes down here. This is an oil supply which gets siphoned into where the lamp is down here. So you got the lamp burning and giving off not only caloric, which is measured by a calorimeter, not this experiment, but also what else do you get when you burn an oil, an organic oil? CO2, H2O, right? So you're going to measure these. Okay, so here's the thing that collects H2O, the stuff that comes from the gases that come out, condensed. Some of them are in this bulb. The ones that aren't there get condensed here and drip back into that. So when you weigh this at the end, you get how much water was given off by the oil as it burned. Right? Now, some of it might not have been trapped by there. So you have a collector here, something that will, a drying agent that will collect the last of the water. Right? So you have to weigh this at the before and after as well. Weigh this before and after to see how much water. Now, what's still coming after you've got the water out of the combustion products? Obviously, there's a lot of nitrogen from the air that's coming through. And a lot of oxygen still that wasn't used in the combustion that's coming through. And argon, which nobody knew about for another 120 years. Right? Well, what else is coming out? What else is coming out? CO2. That's what this stuff is for. Right? That's a CO2 collector. So there's a little stirrer on top that you stir this thing so that the solution gets stirred up. And in there you have lime water. A base that will react with CO2 to make carbonate, which will stay in the water. So you can weigh these before and after, and you have two of them, so you trap all the CO2. What gets out of the first one gets trapped in the second one. And some water will come out of here, carried up through by the air. That would cause you to lose weight, right? So you have a drying agent here that collects that last water. So you weigh this, this, and this before and after, and the difference is CO2, because the other gases don't get absorbed by the lime water, the nitrogen, the oxygen, the argon. Okay, so you can weigh, and you get it. You get how much carbon and how much oxygen, and how much caloric you got earlier was in the oil. So how do you analyze a substance if it won't burn cleanly, if it doesn't give CO2 and water? There are many things that don't burn well, like sugar doesn't burn well, it chars. Do you ever have candy or something you're making catch on fire and it doesn't burn up the sugar, it turns black and you got stuff that's hard to get off the pan. Okay, so grape sugar wouldn't do it, the le soupe de raisin. Okay, so he says, how can you do it with vegetable things that you want to burn? Everyone knows how wine, cider, and mead are made. So that's what he's going to do. He's going to ferment sugar here, right? And it's going to come up, and there's going to be sugar, yeast, and water here fermenting to give off CO2, right? And then up here, he's going to have something that catches the foam. If you've ever seen anything ferment, it gives off a lot of foam. But the gases, anyhow, will come through here, right? And that will collect water, because you're trying to measure the CO2. You don't want to weigh water. Okay, and then here you have these jars that'll collect the CO2. And then finally, any other gas that's given off will be collected in this bell jar. Now, I've meant to mention in that previous device, that's not a simple thing to use, right? It's a big device, that one where you combust an oil. You got to have somebody running the air supply to keep it constant, somebody keeping an eye on the lamp to make sure that the wick is proper and doesn't go out. You got to have somebody stirring those things to collect. So, you know, it takes three men and a boy to run this thing and Madame Lavoisier overtaking dictation in the corner to do the lab book. Okay, so fermentation can do it. He says it can furnish a means of analyzing sugar, right? So oxidation had failed with air, even with pure oxygen, with sulfuric acid or with mercuric oxide and so on, because you didn't get complete combustion. But he said, I can consider the materials subject to fermentation and the products of fermentation as an algebraic equation. And by in turn supposing each of the elements of this equation to be unknown, I can derive a value and thus correct experiment by calculation and calculation by experiment. So he's assuming that mass is, you say, people say that Lavoisier proved the conservation of mass. In fact, he assumed it. Right? So you have this equation, some things in, out. Suppose there was one of the things you weren't very sure about. You can calculate what it is by the difference of the others. Right? Which is not really, as you know, nowadays considered a proper method of doing experimentation to fiddle with your data. But he says he can go round and round to correct experiment by calculation and calculation by experiment. I have often profited from this way of correcting preliminary results of my experiment. Okay, so here's his bookkeeping. He was, his day job was to keep the books for the people who, for his firm that collected taxes. So he was accustomed to making books balance, and this, all the sous come out exactly right. So he did this here, where he took the constituent elements of the materials of fermentation before, and then after he saw what they were, but we don't have time to go through this now before the exam, so we'll resume here afterwards. Again, remember, this stuff's not going to be on the exam. Okay. Pardon me? This lecture and the last 20 minutes of the last lecture. The stuff about history isn't on the exam. I think you'll have your hands full with the quantum mechanics and the functional groups.